Globalization is a big issue, the things that we deal with in one sense. And when we were talking about globalization the other day, I put forward the idea that globalization, obviously, it means the sort of interconnection of all cultures and societies and all that sort of thing. But more technically, it means, in one sense, the interconnection of society, of human society across the globe. By markets and information networks. I had asked at some point, by the way, today I'm mostly going to lecture both sections. I'll give time for us to have discussions and questions and stuff. But I think on Mondays it's a good idea for me to kind of like lecture and get us into certain types of the material. We were talking about this. I really kind of want to highlight the fact that globalization is a form, insofar as it's an economic phenomenon, it's a form of what you would call global financial capitalism. Okay? And what that means then here is that markets are not just goods, but markets actually become financial systems. In other words, in which every single thing is financialized. It's translated into a financial service or translated into a financial thought. Okay? In order to make it more easily exchangeable. And this word is really, in one sense, the phenomenon we're talking about. Globalization is a kind of exchange network. Okay? And this is important because the phenomenon, what appears, can appear with certain profiles and certain guises. You look at only one aspect of it, right? So in terms of exchange, we are looking at the possibility of exchange as globalized financialization. All right? Of reducing everything down to a dollar sign and then figuring out how it can be traded or it can be financialized or monetized. Right now it can become traded. This has happened. For those of you who are religious and practice a religion, whatever faith it may be, you might look at your own faith, your own church, and ask yourself, how has it become part of globalization? How, when I look at what my pastor says, or my rabbi says, or my priest says, or my mom says, can I say, it kind of sounds like they're translating our religious beliefs into a kind of financial exchange. And again, this phenomenon of exchange, that's part of the human condition. Human beings are exchangers, right? We change out with each other. Okay? We're all, like right now, I mean, in one sense, I'm participating in educationally. Because today I've decided that on Mondays, I mean, I'd already decided this, but I hadn't said it. On Mondays, we'll do more something, the standard educational model, where I'll come in and I'll lecture, and I'll let y'all ask a few questions for clarification, but we won't spend a lot of time discussing with each other. That's called, what do you think that form of education is called? The banking model of education. Where I come in and I deposit into your coffers a certain amount of information. And then at some point, although I won't follow through on it, in a sense, at some point I'm going to ask you to give me back what I've deposited with a little interest. In this case, show me that you're interested in it enough to think it and put it to use a little better. Put it to use somehow, right? So that's how the banking model bears interest, is that when I ask you to tell me back, you don't just give me back exactly verbatim what I said. You give me back something that shows that you thought about it. And that's how I know that the exchange is bearing interest somehow. Capitalism that people normally talk about, and which has had such a huge effect on the entire world, most people, when they think of capitalism, they actually think of little mom-and-pop stores that exchange goods and services, right? That's actually still encapsulated in capitalism. That's the old form of mercantilism, the old form of merchant exchange. Like at the coffee shop, we bring in coffee, right? Coffee beans, and we turn them into products, and we give you that product, and you give us the money. Profit margins are very low, and it's not what would then have been meant classically by capitalism, which was moving towards a kind of industrialization. So you've got two ways that people normally think about capitalism. And this will all bear out with religion. Two ways that people think about capitalism. There's that kind of like mom and pop store, or keep managing big mics and you know making coffees and blah blah blah. And then there's what you would call industrial capitalism, where people actually have factories, industries, they make things. Countries become famous for steel, or they become famous for the production of things like paper or cars or whatever, right? This is industrial production. Always running along inside of this has been, how do we take a thing and turn it into a profit? How do we get something out of it? But the reason it's important to kind of take an idea, take a step back and think about capitalism at the local level, what you experience, at the experience of the nation, in one sense, insofar as it has industrial productivity, and then this notion of financial markets, because financial markets and financial capitalism is global, not national and not local per se, but it dominates the local. And so in this sense, one of the reasons I was asking you about the myth of globalization was, in a sense, to get at how globalization as a narrative kind of has taken over the way that most people, in especially westernized nations, think about systems, think about all the networks that they belong to. But whether you're talking about financial exchange through universal markets, or you're talking about industrial exchange through trade markets, or you're talking about local exchange, right, through just going to the actual market or the actual coffee shop or the actual food store and exchanging something, right, what we're really talking about is exchange. human beings attempt to understand through myths of order how the world works and how they fit into the world. So that you can say there are two aspects of the human condition that concern us when we think about anything. That we order. Right? We're orderers. We like order. And that we exchange. And what's really awesome is when we can develop systems of orderly exchange. In one way, we can think about religions as systems of orderly exchange. And I'm not trying to financialize religion. I'm not trying to economize religion. It's an aspect of the things we take for granted that as soon as I start talking about orderly exchange, we think about economics. And not about the fact that everything we do is about systems of orderly exchange. But in our society, we have presupposed the domination of economics. And if something, especially an aspect of this global financial capitalism, which shows itself in the United States as neoliberalism, that we automatically translate orderly exchange into economics. So that in one sense, while Americans would probably balk at the notion that they have very much, most Americans would balk at the notion that they have very much in common with Karl Marx, The reality of the thing is that whether you're a Christian or a Jew or an atheist, a Muslim, a Hindu, an agnostic, you probably shortcut your interpretation of the world to an economic interpretation pretty quickly. We're talking about orderly exchange. Now, this week we're doing two of the world's great sacred traditions. Great.
I still don't understand what that word means per se. More likely it means big more than anything else. But as systems of orderly exchange, two of the ones we're dealing with this week, mythic sacred traditions, are Hinduism and Jainism, which are born in India and pretty much thrive mostly in India and Sri Lanka, Indonesia, and wherever Indians have actually exchanged themselves from India to another part of the world.
So this week we'll spend time talking about the Vedas, talking about the epics and the stories, Puranas, about the supreme reality or ultimate reality. We'll talk about the different ways of life that are in different religious traditions, whether you follow Vishnu or Shiva. We'll talk about the philosophical systems. Again, during the Axial Age, 800 BCE to about 500 CE, all the world's great religions, all the world's great philosophies were born. Okay? In India, there's some really complex philosophical systems.
extremely complex philosophical systems.
We won't get deeply into that, but you have to know that those philosophical systems, just like in the Muslim world and just like in the Judeo-Christian world, philosophy has had a huge impact on the way that their religion is practiced. We'll talk about certain main public and private rituals, and we'll talk about how you get to Hindu. What is being a Hindu? What is Hindu identity in modern India? It very well may be the case, this is one of those interesting aspects of culture, that just like the Jewish tradition did not have an official, what you call an official canon, until Christianity came along and tried to adopt what you would call the Hebrew Bible as part of the Christian tradition. So it wasn't until after that Jewish rabbis in Alexandria and scholars in Alexandria got together and they said, this is what makes up the Hebrew Bible. In reaction to Christianity trying to co-opt or make use of those books, it very well may be that you can't say that there's Hinduism until there's Jainism and Buddhism. And there's a counter-reaction, right? Okay, so my Hindu friends say that I remind them of Lord Hanuman, Sri Hanumanji. And I've done a lot of work on Hanuman, who is the embodiment of devotion in the Hindu pantheon. But anyway, whenever my Indian friends come over here, that's what they call me. And they poke my stomach, tell me that Hanuman needs to exercise. Because you'll see he's a little more svelte than I am. Okay.
Did you say embodiment of devotion or emotion?
The embodiment of devotion. And that's another concept that we'll spend more time on tomorrow, because I think it's an extremely important one that we need to really spend time on. It's called bhakti. Bhakti is the Hindu word for devotion. My work on Hinduism has been centered on this idea of not of having devotion, but of being devotion. And we'll get into that maybe tomorrow when we talk about this. So, let's just take a quick look at this one Upanishad here. This is an extremely important little snippet from a second Upanishad, which really the Upanishads would have been written around the same time as the text on Taoism that we read the other day. They probably would have been being set down around the same time as the prophet Isaiah and Socrates. Okay. So, as a spider sends forth its thread, and as tiny sparks spring forth from a fire, so indeed do all the vital functions, all the worlds, all the gods, and all beings spring from this self, Atman. Its hidden name, Upanishad, is the real behind the real, Satyasya Satyam. For the real consists of the vital functions, and the self is the real behind the vital functions. A few things that are happening inside of there. I'm going to start with the last concept here. Satyasya Satyam. Sata is the Hindu or the Sanskrit word for being. So the real behind the real means here. This could also be translated the being behind beings.
Yeah. Ones that are worth reading.
All right, so we have Sattva. Satyasya, Satyam. Being behind beings. Or, if we were to take it a little more, and I think this actually works better with the actual philosophizing that's happening in this Upanishad, you have to think about this in terms of process, not in terms of thing. Okay, and this is going to be important to the next slide that I'm going to show you. Being the to be behind beings. Okay, keep that in mind. In English, we suffer from the fact that our unconjugated verbs are verbs in their actual form. They all have to. Which is cool from the phenomenological point of view, wanting to say that everything is an intentionality. So it's a to something, to do, right? But at the same time, you kind of like lose, like in Spanish, ser or être. You actually lose that kind of processionalness that's there. Sein in German. Therefore, we put this little hyphen in there just to be sure we don't forget. This is the process. This is that which is ongoing. Okay, the being behind beings. The real behind the real, the being behind beings, the to be behind beings, the to be behind to beers, the truth behind the truth. Right? For the real consists of the vital functions, and the self is the real behind the vital functions. Now, here what we get with the Upanishad, you see Upanishad is in this name, so Upanishad is a kind of disclosure of how things are. And Atman is the word for soul or the word for self. Now, one of the things that you should know, depending on your education, maybe you do, maybe you don't, is that Sanskrit which means holy writing, so it's actually a name given to the language by Westerners. Sanskrit is directly related to all of the European languages and to Persian. So Persian and all of the European languages, language families, the Romance languages, and the Germanic languages, which includes English. They all developed out of what's called the Indo-European language family. Atman is the Sanskrit word for soul. Suke, or Saki is the way we pronounce it nowadays, but really, suke. Suke is the Greek word. It's really Sanskrit, Greek, Latin,
has actually two spiritus and anima. And all you gotta do there is put an L on it, and you know animals have souls. So these are the ancient traditions at the time. The words from these cultures talking about soul onomatopoeias. They're onomatopoeic. They're the sound of what they're describing. Soul. In soul and ghost, deriving from German into English, are like last breath. So these words actually mean life breath. Prana is also related to that notion of breath too. And in these systems of orderly exchange that we call the great religions, for many, this concept of the life breath, of the vital functions, plays a big role.
Right now, before we move on,
so keeping in mind this Upanishad, this becomes the dominant thinker in Indian religion and philosophy. Brahma is ultimate reality. Brahma as ultimate reality. Brahma as satyasya satya. Brahma as Mata. Atman. Mahatman. Great soul. And this actually will play, and this is very important actually to think about, this will play a big role, this notion of the great soul will play a big role actually in American thinking. Because in the 19th century, Henry David Thoreau and a few other New England, they're called the New England Brahmins, a couple of other New England thinkers, will read some Indian philosophy, and they will put forward something called transcendentalism. All right, which is an American form of philosophy that says, you know, that nature is the expression of is the visible and experienceable expression of an ultimate reality that we all participate in. Right, and it will come out in the poetry of Walt Whitman to a certain extent. And especially be adopted by a man named, who was a kind of mentor to Henry David Thoreau, a man named Emerson. But here's the interesting aspect already, see, this notion of global exchange, it's not this globalization, turning the world into one spot, but global exchange, you know, exchange in and around the globe. Henry David Thoreau reads the Bhagavad Gita. Okay, which is an extremely important, popular text in Indian religion. And then
Mahatma Gandhi reads the Bhagavad Gita and most of the religious traditions of the world, and Henry David Thoreau. And then Martin Luther King reads Gandhi and Henry David Thoreau. And this tradition of, and the Gita and the Bible, and this tradition of global exchange that leads to the attempt to change the world we live in, to make a more orderly exchange in the world we live in, you actually kind of see this interesting exchange between India and the United States.
All right. But it's very important now that as we go into talking about India,
the Abrahamic religions are what are considered to be monotheistic, which means what? One God. Okay.
And in some ways, this is a response to Egyptian and Greek religious tradition, which was polytheistic, more than one God, right? Many gods, poly.
It's very easy to look at India and think that you're dealing with polytheism. But the underwriting idea, the underwriting order of Indian religion and philosophy is that there is satyasya satyam, there is the being of beings, there is one reality. And everything is an expression of one reality. Indian religion is not polytheistic, it's monistic, meaning one being. One, everything is one being. And actually, one of the reasons that Christian and Muslim Christian and Muslim
missionaries, you might say, have never been able to convert India is when you start talking about one God as though it's the supreme being, that just meshes up with the Indian way of thinking about things, and they're like, yes, only one being, only the one being. And it kind of like goes, whew. Right? India is particularly not susceptible to religious conversion because its monism is so pliable that even the Jainist and the Buddhist elements that originally derived from India, a lot of that just got re-enveloped back into what we call Hinduism.
I mean, for some Hindus, they would just as easily say that Jesus and Muhammad are, and this, of course, would be sacrilege to a number of people, but that Jesus and Muhammad are avatars of Vishnu, or avatars of God's being. Right? Of being. So.
They have a lot of gods, and maybe what the problem has been is that the Greeks actually might have been more monistic than we realized they were. But because their religion basically was persecuted out or died out, depending on how you want to talk about it, what you're left with is basically post-Greek thinking about late Greek thinking about that religion, and that's mostly been recorded by Christians and even Jews who actually oriented themselves towards people like Plato and Aristotle, who philosophically had said, no, it really makes more sense that there's only one God, not so, you know,
we just go ahead in some ways and we wonder, right? It's like our common heritage is we look at them and we see that they seem to have separated the world up into different powers that were all kind of interacting with each other. So maybe they weren't monistic. And it's quite possible, maybe they were polytheistic, not monistic. And it's very possible that we could say that when you look at the Rig Vedas, the oldest religious tradition of India, which really in some ways although Hinduism has kept the Vedas, it very well may be that if it's correct to say there's no Hinduism until there's Buddhism and Jainism and some other, that the Vedas are pre-Hindu, and that in the pre-Hindu Vedas, just like in the Iliad or the Odyssey or any of the traditions coming out of Greece or even some of the older ones of the Etruscans and the Romans, that the ancient Indians were polytheistic. And then they developed a philosophy of monism. Whereas the Greek world, by adopting Christianity, made a lateral move from polytheism to monotheism. They, in adopting these ideas behind the Upanishads, moved in the direction of monism, so that you still have this, what you would call this, this myriad examples of the being of beings, of the to be of beings, Shiva, Vishnu, Brahma, Indra, you know, Hanuman, Ganesh. But people understand that those are expressions of the one being.
So they're all altars of the being.
They're all visible expressions of this, just like you are. So this is another issue. You're a visible expression of the Satya Satya, Satya Satya.
Which means that God is in everything.
Well, it's not. See, that's an interesting thing. That monism is not the same thing as pantheism. Pantheism would be God is everywhere. Monism is simply there's only one being. And sometimes that being expresses itself as Brahma. Sometimes it expresses itself as Amida. I'll get that stress by the end of the stress. Right? Is that begin to accomplish some sort of a reply? It's a good question, actually. But in this sense of the monism, it's really kind of more like, think about like before you had the image of the fire with the sparks coming off of it. Here you can also kind of think about it as water, a body of water, and all the droplets of water that are still water. Right? And the water returns to the water. Sometimes it becomes ice, sometimes it becomes mist, but it always goes back to the ocean. It always goes back to the great body of water. Sometimes we might look at it like this. This is one that my teacher, George James, who first taught me phenomenology of religion and is a good friend of mine who teaches here, he often talks, this is an example he learned, I think, in India, talks about, think about reality as a glass of water. And you know how I'm with, some of y'all probably thought that was still Topo Chico, and you were like, oh my God, it's going to go everywhere. It's just regular water now. But you see the bubbles that are in it? Right? So actually, what you have is in the flow of the water, is that the water's all there, but just like with the Tao, when we were saying the boundary, right, the differentiation is the mother of 10,000 things, putting the boundary around something, there's these little air bubbles, these little boundaries, and everything really is the tension between, in one sense, is the tension between air and water. And as this comes up,
it bursts, right? And the water goes back to the place it is. But then at the same time, the air itself contains aspects of water in it, and it condenses and comes back down. So it's this constant flow. Okay. So think of monism as beings are all expressions of the same being, of the same to be, the same process. All right, so here we have from the more popular expression from the Bhagavad Gita, which is the book about Krishna, Lord Krishna. You see the Hare Krishna, which is a religious organization in the United States and around the world, and it's actually the only, or it's like one of the only Indian, it's actually one of the only Hindu-related religious organizations that you might say tries to convert people. Generally, one of the things that you'll find if you go to an Indian temple, and they're very welcoming, you know, if you go to an Indian temple, the first couple of three questions you're going to get are going to be something along the lines of, why are you here? Not like when a Baptist asks you what church you go to or why are you here, but why'd you come here? Why, you know, because it's generation after generation after generation after generation after generation have been going to a Shiva temple, going to a Hanuman temple. That's their family god, their expression of the divine in their family, and they're like, why are you coming here? Because they're generally not a conversion religion. So, here in the United States, there's something called the Hare Krishna, who are part of an organization that does go out and tries to get people to become followers of Krishna, right? So they'll give away copies of the Bhagavad Gita. But anyway, the Gita is actually the most popular religious book, the most popular because it's one that almost everybody reads and almost everybody makes use of in Hinduism. Lord Krishna is an avatar. That means he's an incarnation. He's an incarnation of Vishnu. And here what we have. All states of being, goodness, passion, or ignorance, are manifested by my energy. I am, in one sense, everything, but I am independent. I'm not under the modes of this material nature. So, one of the aspects that we'll be dealing with here is again, this thing that pops up regularly inside of human explorations of the world, which is that reality isn't what it appears to be. Or what reality is not what things appear to be. Has anybody in here ever read the Bhagavad Gita? Or sections of the Bhagavad Gita? Yeah. There's one point in the Gita when Krishna, and this is the depiction of it here in the picture, where Krishna is going through basically all of the different gods and becoming all the different gods and showing that he is all of these things, and he's also becoming all of the different things in the world, and he's showing Arjuna here, who's the person he's talking to, he's showing Arjuna how he is all things. And there's a really important scene inside of all that that gets quoted misquoted at the explosion of the first atomic bomb. Oppenheimer misquotes the Gita and says, as the bomb is exploding, he misquotes the Gita and says, "I become death, destroyer of worlds."
or behold, I've become death, or something like that. The quote actually is, behold, I am Shiva, destroyer of worlds. But Shiva is also the maker of worlds, so you destroy and he destroys and he remakes. Right?
Professor Keith.
Yes.
The real being, his name is Vishnu?
He's an avatar of Vishnu. See, this is where it's very easy to like come into the notion of, well, we're dealing with polytheism. But in reality, what we're dealing with is there's an aspect of being which arises and identifies itself as Vishnu. Vishnu is connected to the ages of the world, and he comes at different points throughout the ages of the world to put the world is always wanting to become disorderly. This notion of order, disorder, very important. So the world is becoming disorderly, and he comes into the world to try to put it back on the right path.
But he is also
Brahma.
Brahma is the main thing.
Satyasya Satyam, Brahma. Then there's the triumvirate Brahman, Vishnu, Shiva. But they're all the one being. They're expressions of the one, different expressions of the one being.
Three in one and one in three, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And what you get then with Hinduism across, because you know India,
India in the area of India, I mean there's national India today, but the area of India used to be Pakistan and India, and so the Indian traditions were all throughout this what's called the subcontinent, this huge area of Asia. Right? It's a collection of diverse traditions. Now, here's a word that you need to know, because it's going to pop up again in Buddhism and in Jainism, and it's an important word because there is no word for religion in Sanskrit. There's actually no word for religion in most languages. It's dharma, which means moral order, duty, righteousness, and religion. If you think about the fact that the word religion, Cicero once wrote, I think I told y'all this last week, Cicero once said that religion means the practicing of, dedication or devotion to a practice that's connected to how we think the world is working. So, in that sense, this word means religion. But, Hinduism is a dharma. Jainism is a dharma. Buddhism is a dharma. And that word, in that sense, is related to the Greek word nomos, which is economy. It means order. It means customs. Okay? The word economy actually means the customs of the house. The rules or the laws of the house, the duties of the house. But we're talking a little bit about, we'll talk more about dharma. We're talking about a civilization that's one of the oldest civilizations.
it goes back to actually probably being, you know, we were talking last week about standing stones in Turkey, which were from about 11,000 years ago. After the hunter-gatherers abandoned the standing stone structures, and they seem to have gone to agronomy, the order of agriculture of the farm, right? The duties of the farm. After they started to develop cultures, agronomical cultures, over time those developed into the civilizations, and what's called the Indus Valley Civilization developed, and it's actually probably one of the two oldest civilizations that we have, three oldest civilizations that we have records from, we have things from. There's the Near Eastern Mesopotamic Civilization, the Egyptian Civilization, and the Indus Valley Civilization. All right, let's go on break for about 5 or 6 minutes. Let's take about a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back, okay?